Well, welcome to Adventist Forum. And I apologize, I got so busy talking to our speaker that I kind of ran over our time, but that'll, I guess, give chance for some other people to get in and find a seat. Program today is brought to us by Dr. George Knight, a retired, soon-to-be-retired, he hopes, professor at the seminary, talking to us about the Fat Lady Rides Again, thoughts on the current General Conference initiative toward restructuring the church. And after his presentation, Dr. Brian Strayer from the History Department will be coordinating a question and hopefully not tomato-throwing session afterwards. And so we'll move on into our program. As we begin, Madeline Johnston is going to offer a word of prayer to ask the Lord to be with us in our discussions and deliberations today.
Our Father in heaven, we thank you for the opportunity to come together today. We thank you for the beautiful weather that we have outside today and the blessings of worship that we've enjoyed this morning. We pray that your presence will be with us as we consider the structure of the church that we love. We thank you for our friend George and the insights that you have given him and the many books that he has written and all that he has done to bless this church. And we pray that you will be with him in his presentation today. We know that he will stimulate discussion, and we ask that you will guide in that discussion and that we may all leave here feeling that we know a little more about how we can help our church and maybe where it needs to go and what we can do to help it get there. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Well, as usual, we appreciate the behind-the-scenes work that helps to make this possible. Terry Calkins getting out the announcements and the public relations. And appreciate Jim Harris, Peter Banks, Peter Swanson helping us with the audio so the tapes can be available. And remind you that, in theory at least, the tapes are available through the local ABC. It seems like that periodically the people that answer the inquiries don't always have the information we hope. But there are tapes of past programs available, so be persistent if they don't come up with them for you. And if you would like to receive email notification and aren't on the list, there are a couple sign-up sheets in the back that you can add your name and email. Well, our speaker today, Dr. George Knight, is somebody we know and from our community here. He's a professor in the Church History Department at the seminary. The wider Adventist community is very familiar with his work through his array of speeches and articles and book titles, books frequently with titles that are a little in your face, a little provocative perhaps. Just going through a list of some of his past efforts: Myths in Adventism, Angry Saints, I Used to Be Perfect, From 1888 to Apostasy, My Gripe with God, Organizing to Beat the Devil, The Pharisee's Guide to Perfect Holiness. And then there's the one that sort of gave rise to the sequence of titles that led to today's presentation, The Fat Lady in the Kingdom, one of his less politically correct titles. I was thinking back when George addressed us last about a year and a half ago. As I recall, he was in a suit and so on, and now I see that he's dressed a little more in anticipation of his impending official retirement here, so I guess that's a good sign of what lies ahead. George has had an interest and been active in writing and talking about the area that he's talking about today. You may recall that I think it was GC session before last, he addressed the General Conference session on in this area. He's published books and so on. Last autumn council, a new commission was set up, the Commission on Ministries, Services, and Structures, to look at the Adventist church structure and how to better utilize the resources we have. And again, Dr. Knight's been active in that. addressed them a couple of times. In fact, last April presented a paper to their meeting on organizing for mission the development of SDA Adventist organizational structure. So he's well-informed, well-known, loved and hated on this topic, depending on which side of it you're on. And we're glad that you can be with us, especially since you've moved to Oregon and aren't as readily available in this community. So it's really good to have you back. Time's yours.
And by the way, I didn't get a tape from the last one I did yet. Okay, well, you're right about one thing. That's a disgusting title. The Fat Lady Rides Again. I suppose I should say just a little bit about how I got into this. Some years ago, there was a group of students that had asked me to write an article on mission that would help the church. And so I wrote a parable, recognizing that in the scripture, the church is referred to as a female. That's where the lady aspect came in. But in my parable, it's an obese lady. That's us. That's the Adventist Church, holding a lot of packages in four different varieties: ecclesiological, educational, medical, publishing. And she just stands there sweating in front of the door. But if she lets loose of any of the packages, anyway, the idea is that the overweight lady gets her identity now from her structures and institutions rather than from her mission. And anyway, I wrote the article, and the students came back to me and they said, "We can't accept something like this. This is too radical." So I said, "Okay, I'll send it to the Review." And I sent it to the Adventist Review. They phoned me back the same day and said, "We love the article, it's just what the church needs, but you've got to get rid of that title." I said, "There's no way to get rid of the title, but you guys sit down and call me back when you've got a better one." Well, we finally published it on All Days, Valentine's Day, 1991. Didn't seem to be appropriate to me. With the title and a large disclaimer at the bottom dealing with symbolics. For about the next 3 months, the Review was deluged with letters, more letters they claimed than they'd ever gotten on any other article. And they said, "Finally, we're not going to publish anything else." 99.8% of the letters were favorable, 0.2% didn't like the title. Anyway, that kind of put me on a trajectory, and I kept speaking and writing on the topic, and finally in 95 put out a book of essays, The Fat Lady and the Kingdom. And then a few years later, did a history of the Adventist Church Organization, Organizing to Beat the Devil, the Development of Adventist Church Structure. But some of the folks, the first printings out, they're not all excited about the word devil. So it's kind of come out called Organizing for Church Growth and Mission. It's all right. Because I got another one coming out at the same time called If I Were the Devil, which is a play on my Toronto General Conference speech, and it'll have all the essays in here plus another 10, including the paper that I presented that I'm going to talk about today. Now, I've also had the privilege of dealing with three or four doctoral students on this topic. Andy Mustard did the dissertation on the 1861-1863 organization, and then I had a student, Eric Baumgartner, who teaches here now. I put him onto the 1901-1903, hoping he would do it at Fuller. He just did a term paper for me, and Barry Oliver finished it off. Excellent. Both of those are published, both Mustard and Oliver, by the Andrews University Press. Now, over time, We've seen attempts at tinkering around with the organization. The Perth annual council session tinkered. But tinkering, I kept trying to tell people, is not going to do any good. And some people are tired of paying for machinery. And whether we like it or not, there's a lot of supportive and not so supportive Adventist ministries running around out there screaming, "Give us your tithe," as well as local churches. My guesstimation is, I don't have any exact statistics, but probably 50 to 60% of the legitimate tithe is not going through channels. And I raised this to the brethren some time ago, brethren and sisters, I've got to watch out, this political correctness could get me in trouble. Us dinosaurs have a hard time with these things. I go back and read the stuff I wrote 20 years ago and I can't remember, I can't imagine what a bigot I was, you know. And I don't think I've changed all that much, except my vocabulary. Anyway, I gave quite a talk to the year-end meetings of the North American Divisionalists in Battle Creek in 2004, and I was shocked as the people that came up to me afterwards, I'm talking about division committee members, lay people, saying, these are leading lay people. We don't pay all of our tithe through the system. Leading pastors saying, well, we don't encourage it, but if we didn't get local tithe, we couldn't survive. And these are the kinds of issues that the church is facing, and they're not unrelated. That is the structural issues. As I told the annual council in Iguazu Falls, Brazil in 98, we've outbeasted the beast. When it comes to organization, we're the most heavily organized church in the history of Christianity. When I wrote that up, when that was published in the review, the editors were nice enough to edit this. When I said that we were the most heavily organized church in the history of Christianity, they put in parentheses, except the Roman Catholic Church. I crossed that out and put including the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church has two levels above the local congregation. We have four. Now, I must say, I believe in church organization. I believe in food, too. But too much of a good thing may not be good for you. Anyway, at the annual council of 2005, two commissions have been set up. One commission has to do with the legitimate use of tithe. And I think I'm not on either commission. I've been meeting with the one on structure. I think we're going to see some recommendations come out that might make sense. I don't want to get off on that. I could. No, I got a mission here. The other commission deals with structuring the church. And I've had a thesis for many years that I've published in quite a few places that says the Adventist church doesn't do anything until it verges on the border of bankruptcy. And then it will vote something new. But I was happily surprised by the kinds of things I'm hearing. The first preliminary meeting of the Committee on Structure, it was just to get the stuff on the table. And that was held in January 10th and 11th in Florida. And it was the officers of the General Conference, the President, Vice President, Secretary, Treasurer, and all the division presidents. And I was asked to present a paper at that meeting. I thought I would have 30 minutes. With about a 30-minute question and answer session. Well, I showed up with a 53-page paper, and I got 3.5 hours. I found out that these people are serious. But I went into the meeting knowing that the central office, that is the vice presidents, were split right down the middle between those who believe that the organization we have is a gift of God and is divinely inspired, and those who believe that we need to desperately do something if we're going to get off of dead center. And so part of my task, and this is kind of a dual thing, I want to basically talk about the argumentation that I developed, because if we couldn't get it by the central core of the church, we don't stand much of a chance elsewhere. The other half of this will be to take a look at the papers by Jan Paulsen and others, where we're going with this as a church. Well, nobody knows where we're going, but let me just tell you that I am encouraged. For a topic I've thought about for a long time, I didn't think anything would happen. It may not. But I'll tell you the discussions in a bit. Well, there's a clock over there. I want to, there's no air in this place, is there? Got some air? Well, these people are going to fall asleep on me. That affect my self-image. There were several things that I needed to do in this paper, and one of them was to deal with why we had organization in the first place, and largely was because of three stubborn facts. One, time that just would not come to an end. Two, a broadening concept of missiological responsibility. And three, numerical growth. At the center of the issue in the earliest Adventist church was the problem that we were anti-organizational. George Storrs, back in 43, had taught during the Millerite movement that the first step towards organization is the first step to be toward becoming Babylon. Babylon viewed as oppression. And none of the six denominations that would grow out of Millerism could organize within 20 years because of this concept that organization was evil in and of itself. The church organization was Babylon, the first step towards church organization would be a step towards disaster. Well, as the 50s went on, 1850s, and as James and Ellen White began to recognize the problems that Adventism was facing, they came up with a new definition of Babylon. They moved off of oppression and began to see Babylon as confusion. And as James will hammer home, the Adventists, the Sabbatarian Adventists, were about as confused as anybody could get, and they couldn't move in the same direction with each other because everybody was pulling in a different direction. And James, in his very nice way, wrote to one gentleman, "As Babylon signifies confusion, our erring brother has the very word stamped upon his forehead." Anyway, one of the first things that the whites had to achieve was to move the concept of Babylon from oppression to the understanding that Babylon can also be confusion. And they realized they could not have an effective mission without some kind of organization. And they didn't want this. I've argued that they were forced into it. I suppose you know there's only one real Adventist problem, don't you? Christ hasn't come. And from time to time, that little problem forces us to rethink issues and how we're going to do business. But the rethinking has never come easy. The first time we organized was 1861, 1863. It took us 10 years. There was only 3,500 of us. We were all white. North Americans, pretty much from New England and the Middle West. New Englanders transplanted. And it took us all that time. The next time will take 15 years. We start out in 1888 with a membership of 28,000. We end up in the year 1903 with about 78,000. Largely North Americans and people who look and act like North Americans. But it was almost impossible to reorganize. What about today? 15 million? 200 and something nations? The issues, even the way we look at political processes. Do you know that the majority of the church has no understanding of the political system that this church is based upon, North American democracy? Most built by vote by tribal or some other collective system. We face interesting issues even to talk about reorganizing now. But back in the early days, and something that needed to be stressed to these brothers and sisters in 2006 is the authority for organization in the first place. On what grounds? And the original hermeneutic of the denomination, including James White, was that you can't do anything unless the Bible explicitly teaches that. This will be the battle line. An issue of hermeneutics. James White will eventually conclude that anything that is in line with common sense and the Bible doesn't forbid is allowable. Now, you can probably see other applications to that principle, can't you? I know Madeline can. Anything that is in line with common sense and the Bible doesn't forbid. Now, that's a million miles away from saying it has to be explicitly stipulated. And that's the frontier on which the battle had to be won before we could have organization at all. That is, organization above the local congregation. And that struggle was a mighty one. I've got so many good things to read here, but I'm recognizing that I'm not going to read most of them. That struggle, when that battle was finally won, that we could operate according to common sense, and if the Bible didn't forbid it, it was all right. Then we could organize conferences. You see, the Bible doesn't talk about conferences, but James White says it doesn't talk about publishing houses either. Or periodicals. He said there's a whole lot of things that we're doing that the Bible doesn't talk about. And so James White carried the battle for a period of years. Moving the church from one principle to another. When that was done in 1861, of course they couldn't even choose a name. You've got to realize where these people came from. 60 nominations came out of Millerism. None could organize within 20 years. Well, not quite 20. Even to choose a name was to act like Babylon. But they finally did. They had to. They couldn't incorporate property without a name. So they chose Seventh-day Adventist in 1860, 1861. They made their first local conferences. And then in 1863, they needed something to coordinate the local conferences. But anyway, it was the hermeneutical battle. The two major theological issues were the redefinition of Babylon and the hermeneutical issue. And they knew why they were organized. Of course, these two points, you see, I had to be able to sell I've got an evangelistic audience in this January 2006 meeting of about 20 people. The officers of the General Conference and 13 division presidents. And if we couldn't carry that audience, that was it. I mean, it wouldn't have been it, but it wouldn't have gone anywhere even after we go through the motions. The common denominator of the reasons for organization had in 61, 63 had to do with mission. The plain fact is that the one object that propelled James and Ellen White towards formal church organization was that Seventh-day Adventists could not effectively carry out their mission of spreading the message of the third angel without satisfactory organization. It should be noted that neither of the Whites had an exact organizational plan in mind when they began agitating for church order in 1853. And as Andrew Mustard points out, at no time did Ellen G. White express herself before 1863 on the precise form of organization to be adopted. She was not even included among the nine persons appointed to draw up the proposal for church organization in 1861. Now, this is an important point because there's some people in Adventism that believe that everything that we have came directly from Ellen White. Now, she's only for organization. She had no ideas of how to do it. If she did, she kept them to herself. That point, of course, is an important point when you're talking to Adventist leadership. Now, the 1890s would see a massive struggle in Adventism over the issue of organization. We usually don't hear about this. It's becoming more well known. My first introduction to it was when I did a biography of A.T. Jones, because A.T. Jones had an ecclesiology that basically says this: all church organization is an ultimate evil. Church organization is the Holy Spirit. That's it. That's all you need for church organization. Church organization is the Holy Spirit. Now, let me unpack that now. The Holy Spirit speaks to every person. And if the Holy Spirit is speaking to every person, and every person is responding to the Spirit, then you're going to be moving together. What I call ecclesiological anarchy. That you don't need structure to get cooperation. That was Jones's view, and with him went Wagoner and Prescott. This was the ideological wing of the church. They were looking for a Christocentric ecclesiology. The other half of the church leadership, Willie White and E.G. Daniels, said that works out fine in your head, but we live in the real world. And we've got to get things done. And so you had this struggle taking place. It will come to a climax at the 1901 General Conference session. It will be finished up in 1903, and when it's over, the losing side exits the church. Don't ever think that John Harvey Kellogg left over pantheism. He left in the midst of a power struggle, that he couldn't get A.T. Jones into the primary position. That is, one of his guys that he could control. One of those guys didn't leave. That was Prescott. He switched sides, saw the light on things, and became vice president under Daniels in 1901. But at any rate, during the 1890s, we're facing a struggle, really the only ecclesiological struggle we've ever had as a church. The other side was the mission group. They knew the problems in the mission field. It took 4 to 6 weeks to get a letter to headquarters in Washington, D.C. It took another 4 to 6 weeks to get a letter back, and then they might say, clarify. It might be 6 months before anything could be done in Australia. And that's probably good news, because these people out in the mission fields had to improvise. Old A.T. Robinson, down in South Africa. You see, let me just back up for a second. In North America, we did not have departments of the General Conference or departments at all. We had independent organizations for Sabbath school, education, the medical work. They were all legal entities, had their whole staff of officers for everything. Pearl Robinson got down there and says, I can't afford this. And he said, can I make departments in the conference? He was told he couldn't do it. But mail was so slow that he had it working before he got the answer. And then Robinson moved to Australia. And in Australia, they were told you can't have union conferences. You see, they wanted something intermediate between the general conference. They wanted something that could coordinate things in their part of the world. They were basically told they couldn't do it. Well, they had a weak general conference president. They just waited until they got him down there. Then Daniels and Willie White strong-armed them, and that was it. They had a union conference. And Robinson had come, so they had a union conference with departments. And they found out that it worked. It really helped the work of the church. In 1901, they brought these concepts to the General Conference session. You see, they had the possibility to experiment. Without experimentation, we would have never arrived at our current organizational structure. And yet that current organizational structure has done everything it can to block further experimentation. Only by necessity. I could tell you some necessities, but that's not the main line of mine. I mean, where we have changed, even under the current rigid structure. Anyway, what was Ellen White's role this second round? She was merely a spark plug. She just got the reorganization move going in 1901. She never had any plans on how to do it. See, that becomes very important when you talk about inspired church structures, because we hear a lot of that kind of talk. So I'll read some statements later on and tell you their dates. The outcome in 1901 was that we adopted a departmental system for the entire church and the union conference system. There were a few problems. We didn't have a president because the Jones-Kellogg clique had an Ellen White quotation that said you shouldn't have a president. She was talking about a president had ultimate powers, one man power. But they took that to its illogical conclusion and said we can only have a chairman and he can be dumped whenever the executive committee wanted to dump him, which was right on for Kellogg because he controlled one-third of the votes on the executive committee and influenced about another third, so he could do what he wanted with the church. The medical department was not included in the reorganization. In 1903, it will be. And that's the end of Brother Kellogg. He's not going to be run around by a bunch of preachers or anybody else. I want to talk just for a minute about the Ellen White's evaluation of what happened in 1901, that becomes important for what's going to be talked about down the track. It was positive. During the General Conference, she wrote in November 1901, the Lord wrought mightily for his people. Every time I think of that meeting, a sweet solemnity comes over me and sends a glow of gratitude to my soul. We have seen the stately steppings of the Lord our Redeemer. We praise his holy name, for he has brought deliverance to his people. By the way, the only basis of the 1901 reorganization was mission, effectiveness for mission. There was no formal ecclesiology. Ellen White also had good things to say about the new structure specifically. The day after the above statement was published, she wrote, and I quote, the division of the General Conference into district union conferences was God's arrangement. in the work of the Lord for these last days, there are to be no Jerusalem centers, no kingly power. She was concerned about that one man in the presidency who ruled the entire church. Her happiness with a new arrangement, however, would soon turn to despair. At the beginning of 1903, she wrote that the result of the last General Conference has been the greatest, the most terrible sorrow of my life. No change was made. Now, by the way, massive changes were made, okay? But from her perspective, no change was made. The spirit that should have been brought into the whole work as the result of that meeting was not brought in because men did not receive the testimonies of the Spirit of God. As they went to their several fields of labor, they did not walk in the light that the Lord had flashed upon their pathway, but carried into their work the wrong principles that had been prevailing in the work at Battle Creek. The basic idea here is they had a new structure, but they had the same old spirit. That is kingly power. So Ellen White could praise the new structures, but she was totally devastated that people used the new structures for the same old ends. Well, one further adjustment. Now, you see, at this time, we had a quite functional system for the church that we had at that time. We have a general conference, unions, conferences, local church. But there were still these regional coordinations that the General Conference needed to have some interest in. This became very clear when Ludwig Conradi, powerful German, created a second General Conference in Europe and didn't even put Daniels on his conference committee. Daniels and Conradi will finally have a showdown, at which Daniels wins, and there's still one unified General Conference. But Conradi's back a couple of years later. You get thrown out the front door, you sneak around and climb in the back window with what he called the Division Conference. It would have its own constituency. And that got voted in 1913, but World War I knocked it out. But the problem would show up in America if you had a division conference. Of what use was the coordinating body, the General Conference? The division conference, with its own constituency, had all the money and all the personnel. And so they did away with the division conference and went to divisions of the General Conference, which was a checks and balances system, where you've got coordination throughout the world, but you've got individual divisions nominating their leadership. But if the people are too far out of line, the World Church doesn't have to vote them in. It's an interesting system. I think it's not a bad one myself, given the complexities. What it means to run a church in 206 or 7 nations. Or as I told the brethren in one of my speeches some years ago, an annual council, my lead words, there's only two Catholic churches in the world today. The Roman Catholic and the Adventist Catholic. Catholic means universal. How is it that you convert, that you have a universal organization? There's very few in the world, you can count them probably on one hand, that are unified. Well, I think we have to recognize the blessing of what we have and the complications that it brings. At any rate, I want to move down just a bit because I'm still mentioning some of the things I told the delegates in Florida. One of the final categories was Ellen White and future reorganization. This is part of my paper. From an historical perspective, should Adventism even think reorganizational thoughts in the 21st century? After all, didn't Ellen White plainly state, and I quote, that it has cost us much study to erect this structure? It has been built up by God's direction. Let none of our brethren be so deceived as to attempt to tear it down. In the name of the Lord, I declare to you that it is to stand, strengthened, established, and settled. Ah, some of the people love that quotation. Unfortunately, it was made in 1892.
It does not deal with the current organizational structure. It's the previous one. She's dealing with the principle of organization, not the exact form of organization. Another quotation from Ellen. So I had to deal with this kind of stuff because you've got to get this stuff on the table. If you're dealing with some people who think that this is an absolute blueprint that God has somehow handed down to the Adventist church and that we can never deviate from it, that's what needed to be met. Another quotation from Ellen White has the advantage of being written several years after the 1901 reorganization. In 1905, she wrote, "We cannot now enter into any new organization." That appears in selected messages with no new organization as a supplied heading. Unfortunately, that heading distorts the author's original meaning. The statement in its context, cut off in mid-paragraph in the published version, was a warning to those who were tempted to join up with the schism being fomented by J.H. Kellogg and A.T. Jones at that very time. A contextual reading of this and other Ellen White statements indicate that she was not saying that the 1901-1903 structure was unchangeable. Well, some may be thinking, what about Ellen White's quite explicit approval of the union conferences? The exact statement reads that the divisions of the General Conference and the District Union Conferences was God's arrangement in the work of the Lord for these last days. There are to be no Jerusalem centers, no kingly powers. The statement's context indicates that her main concern was the decentralization of authority. As Oliver notes, the reference to district union conferences was incidental. Beyond that, she uplifts both districts and unions as two different things in our history. The essential point was that a division of responsibilities had been made, and that division was God's arrangement. I would suggest that properly empowered rural divisions on the 1918 model could fulfill in every way Ellen White's approval of unions. And my closing remarks, after I hand out about 20 challenges, including whether some of the brethren are willing to vote themselves out of office for the good of the church. Let's face it, IBM would be bankrupt today if middle management sat on their boards. You got the idea? Middle management sits on all of our boards. So are we more interested in the kingdom of God or worldly position? That's what it comes down to. And that's not the only issue, but it's definitely one of them. Because I'm going to tell you the hardball politics are this. We've got 600 legal corporations out there, 500 conferences roughly, 100 unions. They are all legal corporations that must vote themselves out of office individually. You understand what that means. Crossing the Red Sea will be a minor feat. But I still believe in miracles. Sometimes there are miracles driven by tithe shortage, but that's all right. I still believe in miracles. I got kind of out of hand in that 3.5-hour discussion. Said a lot of things on frontiers I probably should have kept to myself. I later, 3 months later, apologized to Jan Paulson. He said, no, we're glad you got all that garbage on the table. He didn't say garbage, that's my way of putting it. It needed to be raised. Some final thoughts. A body of 78,000 members to a truly worldwide membership of approximately 15 million. But modes of transportation and communication have transformed the very nature of doing business. Adventism has yet to adjust to those momentous changes. Should it? That is the question of questions. This is my conclusion. That is the question of questions, but who is there to answer it? Ellen White was the spark plug that got things finally moving in 1901. And I can tell you right now, without Ellen White, nothing would have happened. I firmly believe that. I've been watching these guys struggle together for all those years, and they did nothing at hash but the church. Ellen White didn't want to go to Australia, but I'm telling you right now, she sure didn't want to come back to this mess. And she's a woman that could speak just like James. I wonder what it was like when the door was shut. That's all right, that's another topic. She and her husband had spark-plugged the thing back in 1861. Yet, she has been dead for nearly a century. And since her death, Adventism has struggled in a quandary with issues that she did not specifically speak to. Or as I put it in one of my classes, the collective brain of Adventism died in 1915. But time moves on. And Adventism in 2006 exists in a world unimagined in 1901. It faces new challenges and possibilities. Such times can be met by facing backward or forward. Anyone who has studied Ellen White's life and ministry can hardly imagine her among that group. Her husband categorized as thinking that all that was necessary to run a train of cars was to use the brake well. To the contrary, she was always at the forefront of those pushing the borders of doing things better and more efficiently. That was a part of her prophetic voice. We may not have a living prophet amongst us today, but we dare not lose the prophetic spirit that continually put Ellen White at the forefront of Adventist mission and advancement toward structural efficiency. That was my evangelistic appeal. That brings us to the discussion. The discussion in Florida. I had really not gone there expecting much openness, to be truthful. I was very happily surprised. And I was more than surprised, I was shocked. They began to talk about flexibility of organizational structures, that we don't need to be organized the same way in every division. That there would be, could be, possibly, new ways of looking at a world church. The president of the largest world division made a speech and he said, let's separate politics from structure. Let's not vote, let's not make general conference votes by population. Let's do it so many votes per division. That'll take the politics out of this. I talked to Israel Leto, this man who made the speech later. He said, coming from me, that had credibility. Coming from one of the European fields, it would have had no credibility because they're the smallest divisions. But suddenly we're beginning to find world leaders willing to think new thoughts. That brings us 3 months later, April 11, one-day meeting at Loma Linda. The agenda, a series of papers, Ecclesiology and Reorganization, The Oneness of the Church by Angel Rodriguez, Lowell Cooper, Reasons for Considering Adjustments in Seventh-day Adventist Church Ministries and Services and Structures, myself, Organizing for Mission, the Development of SDA Organizational Structure, and Vern Parmeter of the Secretariat, the Flow of Ministries. And then in the afternoons, open discussion. Let me just read a few words from Jan Paulsen. This was the opening introduction to the committee for its first time in session. I should say the commission. The commission. What is it that brings us to the point where annual council has yet again set up a commission to look at how we are governed and how we function organizationally? Does it signal a crisis, or is it normal in a community such as ours? It seems to me important that we acknowledge such a reexamination to be normal and is something that we will need to be done from time to time also in the future. Therefore, whatever comes out of the work of this commission, it would probably be good to see it as a chapter in the book of our church, a book that will not be completed until the journey is over, for the church is a living organism and life is dynamic. Let's see. He basically highlighted several principles that he believed should guide the committee. One would be unity. We have a worldwide mission according to Revelation, the 14th chapter, and worldwide missions take coordination.
Second guiding principle would be mission, and that is, that's the reason we're here, and that whatever structures we have should be responsive to mission in its most effective manner. Thirdly, corporate and government models are no pattern for the church. Now, you could have added other ecclesiastical models also, like medieval. At any rate, we shouldn't just be bound by corporate or political models. And the need for flexibility was a fourth guiding principle that Jan Paulsen set forth. And he tucked into that also new criteria for tithe sharing and representation must be developed to accompany flexibility proposals. Fifthly, increased need for better communication and reciprocality from the top to the bottom with information flowing both directions. All you had to do was let the union and conference and local people get loose, and you realize what a jungle we have in terms of communication from the top of the system to the bottom of the system, and how things are not flowing well either direction with as many places to get roadblocked as we have. And lastly, local talents must increasingly find better ways of expressing themselves in creative leadership ministry, an emphasis on local initiative also. We must try to set, I'm reading his final words, we must try to be set free from ourselves. I like this. We must try to be set free from ourselves and the specific role we may now fill in the church so that we can go into this assignment with pure hearts, concerned only for the good of the church, and specifically focused on one, the global unity of our church, and two, the most effective use of resources for missions. That was the president of the General Conference, his initial statement. And then Lowell Cooper, I won't read anything else, but Lowell Cooper, Vice President of the General Conference and assistant the Vice Chairman of this commission. Cooper is an interesting fellow. I think we need to watch him in a good way. Now, there's some other people we need to watch too, okay? Okay. They watch us, we watch them. It's mutual. Lowell Cooper. Out of the gate here, change is constant and inevitable. Every organization and individual is affected in some way or another by changes beyond their control. Similarly, the environment in which the church lives out its mission is dynamic, not static. One of the tasks of leadership is to anticipate, monitor, and respond to change while ensuring that the church is anchored to those realities that do not change. The greatest risk lies in ignoring or not recognizing that change is occurring. Both Cooper and Jan Paulsen are well aware of the fact that change is taking place with or without the General Conference. That's the seriousness of the nature of this whole thing. Change is taking place, and it will continue to take place. How can change be guided and met in such a way as to maintain a healthy church? We're dealing with a couple of General Conference leaders who are quite responsive, as I see it, and more so as I've talked to them personally. It is not unnatural for persons to ask questions about the reasons for and necessity of present organizational structure. Some among those who have studied denominational history suggest that it is once again time for the church to review its structural features in light of the significantly changed circumstances since the early 1900s. At the same time, many Seventh-day Adventist members hold to the view that present denominational structure has been divinely inspired and therefore is appropriate and adequate for all time. Such persons may regard any large-scale review of denominational structures to be unwarranted and ill-advised. Anyway, Cooper got the what the president started out with, Cooper expanded upon, and then several others of us, Hill Rodriguez and myself and Vern Parameter, made presentations, and once again there was an open discussion. Now this is a large committee, probably too large. It's got 100 members, but it's got people from all ranks of the church. It's heavily weighted, I must say, though, with division presidents and general conference officers. I think all the vice presidents are on there besides the other officers. But that still leaves plenty of room. All I can say is the conversation was absolutely open. You got conferences out there, you got administrators in parts of the world are saying, you know, what we have now is not working. And open confession. We wanted to be a union conference. Therefore, we had to invent conferences because you can't be a union conference without conferences. So we created them where they didn't exist because we had to have them so we could fit into the inflexible system. Now you talk about waste, particularly in countries that can't even afford anything. And the talk went on and on and on. Ideas of flexibility. Do we have to do everything the same way? And it was alluded to the fact that there are some divisions that can afford what we have. I think that was kind of a nice way to say things to keep the North American Union Conference presidents from having an apocalyptic seizure. At any rate, I got home, and I don't use the email, but I emailed. Yeah, things do change, folks. Well, when I quit the university, I had to start buying stamps. That helped. I emailed Jan Paulson and Lowell Cooper, and I said, I heard the nice talk about the divisions that can afford this. And I said, I think I understand the reason. I didn't call it the thin edge of the wedge, but I could have. I think I understand the reason for such talks at this stage. I said, but before you go too far, you need to do a stratified sample of pastors in a place like North America, professional people, and leading lay people, to see if they agree with the administrators that we can afford this kind of thing. And I believe a stratified sampling technique would be very informative. Well, in conclusion, thanks to Art, I had this in my head. I said, how could any idiot forget what two committees were appointed? I got up this morning and looked through my notes. Well, I know one. About that time, Art phoned and reminded me about the meeting, and I said, look, this is all, by the way, they're creating a website, all the papers. Art hasn't found it yet, but all the papers from this commission are to be published on the web. The church does not want to operate in secret. As I'm going to tell you right now, if the church can't carry the people with it, in fact, the people might be a good pressure group to get the church moving. There's no reason that all the pressure groups should operate from the top down. Two commissions to meet. They're going to bring a report in October. One, to deal with the concept of flexibility. The concept of flexibility in denominational structure. What are the boundaries of flexibility? And what are some models in which flexibility across divisions could operate? Now I have to admit, I've developed in my book, Organizing to Beat the Devil, I've developed some alternative structures, but I never thought of flexibility. I thought we'd always do the same thing everywhere because that's the Adventist way. I mean, I'm gratified, I'm happy that we're willing to at least think. That doesn't mean we're going to change, okay? Get this straight. I'm not
I'm still got both feet on planet Earth. But I've been a change, I've been agitating for change in many areas across my entire career. My doctoral dissertation shaped me. It's in social reconstructionism. I was running away from God at the time and was deep into Marxism and other things. And one day I said to myself, how come it doesn't work? And I said, because they've got a weak anthropology. No concept of sin and evil. Not sufficient. That drove me back to Christianity, intellectually anyway. Took a conversion to get me all the way back. But this concept of change, how do you change across time and still maintain your identity? How do you create change? That's been the driving force in my life now for 30 years, so I believe. I used to be perfect, and I'm still kind of an idealist. But without ideals, you just give up to begin with and accept the status quo. You've got to be willing to believe that the impossible can happen. You have to be rather arrogant to be an Adventist, I'd say. You have to be arrogant to be a disciple. 11 miserable fishermen spreading a message to the ends of the earth, pretty good stuff. But as unlikely as a bunch of dirt poor Adventists back in 1848. Without some vision, you don't go anywhere. Now these people, they helped my vision, man. We got a committee. What are the limits of flexibility? How would this, are there some models for working? And lastly, the place of unions of churches in the denominational structures. Now this one here is not as fruitful to me. Unions of churches, you may not even understand what they are. They don't have the status of a union conference, but they're in nations where they can't afford conferences and don't need them. So they're second-class citizens, such as in Spain, you have a union of churches. There's six other mostly European nations that have a union of churches. It's not a union, and they don't have the rights of a union until they start sponsoring some conferences which they don't need, local conferences. So you can see that these issues are real issues. This commission, my guess is, will not do anything rapidly, and I don't think it should. But my hope and prayer is, if it doesn't do anything rapidly, it keeps on doing what it's been doing and making some progress. The big upset in Florida in January, it was quite an uproar among the division presidents that they were only going to have one day meeting on this in April. They were aggressive towards the general conference officers. We need more. The divisions are pushing this. And they're going to meet twice, two days in October, but I think we're eventually going to have to see after they get the shape of the possible futures. The shape and the possible implications of possible and preferable futures, as they begin to look at these things, then they'll be ready, I think, for a more extensive discussions. Well, I think I held within almost 40 to 50 minutes, Art. All public speakers are supposed to figure out how to get off the platform gracefully. And I thought Brian was going to rush up here and rescue me. Okay, Brian, help me.
First hand. It's the question and answer time, folks. Leona.
My Hebrew teacher back there.
I'm thrilled about the idea that they're open to flexibility. That all parts of the world don't have to do the same thing. Maybe that will open it up for the places that are open for women's ordination to go ahead.
See, Leona, you got to recognize this is a separate issue. But when I saw Madeline here, I noted the hermeneutic issue, because the hermeneutic issue is the key issue in that issue also.
common sense and those things which are not directly forbidden. Unless you think that letting a woman speak in church is forbidden, and as I noted in my article responding to the Utrecht, in that case you only prove that Ellen White's a false prophet, because she spoke in churches everywhere.
This is, again, what has been said before, some years ago. The women can do everything the men can do. Just don't give them the title and the same pay.
Well, I think we give them the same pay now. By the way, I just got back from a ordination service at Pacific Union College. The head pastor there has turned in his ordination papers. He's commissioned. Julius Nam, who I had the ordination sermon for, we'll call it commissioning sermon, refused to be ordained on the basis of principle. He's commissioned. And of course, you know, a commissioned minister now can do anything that a male can do. So it's now we're playing, you know, kind of a word game. But it's more than that, because you can't be General Conference President unless you're ordained. But our first conference administrator was a layperson. That's Adventist history. There's precedent.
I'll try to frame the question the best I can. About now, it's good we want to anticipate having changes, but how can we show this issue?
Two remarks on that. These people are very, very sincere about examining the Bible and the writings of Ellen White. But we have to recognize that we did not get our current organization from either one. The current organization is driven by a missiological principle. And it's that has informed the last two, the only two organizations of the Adventist Church, which is not really two organizations, it's one that's been modified in 1901, 1903. But in terms of the goals of what we're going to achieve, that is at the very forefront. And that's how come there were theoretical studies as well as other types of studies in this. And the church leaders, number one, are not in a position, but neither are they inclined to avoid either the scriptural or the counsel from Ellen White on these issues.
Coming out of Europe, George, I have seen that there is already some flexibility because the Netherlands and Sweden are conferences with union status and are represented as unions.
I don't know how they pulled that off. They say they're not letting the Africans do that.
But it is a fact.
Okay. There's another way of approaching it, and that's what I call the Norway model. When Scottsborg went bankrupt, the great sanatorium for the Scandinavian Union, when it went bankrupt and they had all these retirements to pay for, basically they were bankrupt, the entire union. They split into several unions, but in Norway, in order to keep the union, they have three conferences. They have three conferences, but the conference owns no property and has no employees. They have one pastor who's called the conference president. They have a constituency meeting every 3 years. There's no expense tied to this, but yet, when they have the constituency meeting, the people in that region get to have an input on the national church. It's not a bad idea. Conferences with no substance, you know what I mean, except membership. And the president basically directs the evangelistic work in that section of the church. Bankruptcy does wonderful things. By the way, tribalism is a fierce problem that we're dealing with. Okay.
Yeah, I read your book that you wrote on organizing to be the devil. And I wanted to see if you had written something about flexibility. And I discovered that you didn't have much on that area. But also, what do you think about accountability? Because I thought also accountability is a very important issue when we talk about structure.
I think accountability ought to be cared for in the communication up and down, a two-way. There are several ways of doing church. The Baptists have made very strong congregation, made powerful pastors. In fact, in many Baptist churches of 10 or 20,000 members, the pastor is kind of a one-man, one-woman, I don't know if they got women, one-person kingdom.
and their general structures are extremely weak. We've got a model where there's not much to do, you don't have much to say as a pastor, but the top is very weak. Back in, I think it was for the 1995 General Conference session, I recommended a series of checks and balances with significant power at both the general organizational level and at the local level, so that the power structure could check itself in much the way that the American government checks itself, with checks and balances built into the system. There are many ways to do this. In terms of flexibility, I must admit that I had no imagination about flexibility. I'm an Adventist historian, and that's where my blinders were, right there. We've never been flexible, so why should we ever be flexible now? I can give you the crisis of the Australian division, the South Pacific division. This is the division where we've got both the departments, as we know them now, and the union conferences. They were not allowed to experiment. 15 years ago, they wanted to experiment. They said, we want to do away with unions. The General Conference says, you cannot do away with unions. Those are the building blocks of the church. You can't do it. You can't, it's impossible. We can't give you permission. So that the very division that gave us what we have couldn't experiment. So they said, we'll do away with the local conferences. They couldn't get anybody to vote themselves out of business. Even little Tasmania with 600 members. They don't want to get gobbled up by South Australia. I mean, Victoria. They don't want to get gobbled up. No, tribalism is fierce. You see, every conference has to have a nice office. They got to have their own academy. They got to have, their own youth camp. Every union has to have their own college. And so we just go on and on and on. Tribalism, we talk about it in Africa and some other places. It's rampant in North America, Australia, and other places. And Peter, when it comes to Europe, I need to tell you right now, the Adventist iron doesn't stick to the Adventist clay. Europe stands alone in terms of reorganizational models. You can't even get the Germans to stick together. The North Adventist German clay won't stick with the South Adventist German clay. People can come to this country and live together, but we got several hands up here.
Professor, continuing on the subject of tribalism, I'm curious if there's been any discussion relative to the pending restructure, if there's been any discussion to address our continuing need for racial integration. Specifically, by integration, I am referring to the integration of whites and African Americans, not the integration of whites and blacks. Those are two different things. So I'm curious if there's been any discussion in that context. And secondly, how the pending restructure would impact the ecclesiastic or administrative autonomy of those two groups.
Let me ask a question.
Sure.
What's your country of origin?
South America, Guyana, South America.
Okay. As I travel around the world, I hear a lot of stuff about segregation and all the rest of it. And there's a lot of misunderstandings in most parts of the world about this. And I have to admit, I belonged to a regional conference for 10 years. I was ordained by a black conference, okay? I'm also the only unofficial white on the Bradford Cleveland Center board in Oakwood, and I arrive and I say, the token has arrived, this thing works both ways. But one of the major misconceptions is what we have today is not what we had in 44 or whenever this thing was voted in, because the Lake Region was the first regional conference. At that time, it was the whites that wouldn't let the blacks in. It's a little bit different now. This is segregation by choice. My gut level feeling is that it is the blacks, by and large, the North American blacks, who now have maintaining the regional conferences. And this would be a loss of, power. And the integration is taking place in the other system. And some of those are just as equally African American second, New York has two conferences, one so-called white conference, the other an African-American conference. They're both black, and none of the people there are North Americans. I had the men's meeting there some years ago. Out of 1,000 men in the white conference, there were 3 whites. I'm the only one without an accent, and I didn't belong to the conference. And they were talking about white flight. Well, now I have the statistics that black flight has been equal, that the New York conferences are both island conferences. And so the integration thing is much more complex than it looks like from the outside. I would like to see us be able to move beyond the racial things on both sides, but it cuts both ways. I'm obviously white, okay? But I decided that I would attend a black university for part of my doctoral studies. In Texas, there's 2 universities 6 blocks apart, left over from the segregation days, University of Houston and Texas Southern. Texas Southern is black. I went there to take classes. Wasn't a good idea. I decided I don't have to put up with this. So, you know, these kinds of things work both ways. But I do believe that we need to work on this. This is not one of the items under discussion. But obviously, if you restructure the church in certain ways, the integration would have to take place, which is probably another reason it would be existed, that is restructuring.
First, a couple of observations about the North American scene, and then a question based on it. Number one, I find that local churches, local Adventist churches, are having to compete locally for young adults who have a weak denominational brand loyalty, and they're having to compete with the community church down the street or the Free Methodist Church in Wenatchee, Washington, or wherever it may be. The second observation is that your typical young adult Adventist can't tell you who their conference president is.
Yeah.
Does this signal some movement toward congregationalism, if I may use that dreaded word?
Well, obviously, Bob, the breakdown of brand loyalty of my and your generation is a reality. Congregationalism is a very real issue. It's not going to go away. I addressed the annual council on this in Iguazu Falls. It was, what did I call that, congregation wake-up call or death knell, where we respond by giving more say-so at the local church level. In other words, to use local initiative as well as have coordination of a worldwide body. To me, I believe in both. I don't think we've done a very good job of it. But congregationalism is alive and well. Of course, the latest move we've seen by Ron Gladden. Ron Gladden is different from Richard Fredericks and Clay Peck. I met with them and their conference presidents, at least Clay. And I said, Clay, why don't you just admit it? You're an Adventist, but you're not a Seventh-day Adventist. The way you're heading, you're not going to get up to Sabbath before long, which he did. But Ron Gladden wants to be faithful. Ron tried to draw me into his organization, claiming that I said Ellen White was for congregationalism. I said, no, Ron, how could you get that out of my book? That's what she was fighting against. And I said, I appreciate your views on Revelation 14, but you don't have a delivery system that can handle it. So my way of looking at this, Bob, is we have got to do more to enhance the local congregation. And that's got a lot of, there's a lot of loose ends on that. So that the local congregation has the finances, the money to operate and do initiative of mission and not just handed down programs. In other words, it's got to have some of the advantages of that local freestanding church down the road. Because suddenly our young people say, the local church that supplies a tithe can do nothing but send it upstairs. As soon as it gets the conference and the union, division, general conference, they can buy secretaries, computers, toilet paper, trucks, janitors, whatever they want. The local church that raises it can't do anything with it. And it's these kinds of issues, because we have an educational system and because people have choices, that tithe is directly tied. Now, when I raised this to the North American Division in the Ron Gladden context about a year and a half ago, I was a little worried because the ex-General Conference treasurer was sitting right in front of me, and I know him. I'd stayed with him before. And I'm saying, man, this guy, he may not be swallowing this too good. He came up to me afterward, and he said, you're right on. We're facing a tithe crisis. We're facing a tithe credibility problem. And I think that's the reason that two commissions. I don't think there's any way that we can continue to do business like we've been doing business. I go to a lot of churches now, they got sometimes up to three or four extra pastors that are not employed by the conference. Hold meetings with the ex-president some years ago of Southeastern California. I said, you know, Steve, I was down in your conference and I see all these extra pastors. I said, what do you think they're getting paid? He looked at me, he said, you know what they're getting paid. Now, the system as we've known it, the younger generation is not going to buy into as solidly as our generation did. And as Lowell Cooper very nicely raises, we are getting more and more supporting independent ministries. You got AFM, of course we've always had Voice of Prophecy, but we got AFM that got us off dead center as far as I'm concerned, missiologically. We got all these organizations, and people know that if they put their money here, something's going to happen. This, instead of somebody getting paid. Now, what the other side of this is, these supportive ministries are not paying for the support structures. And this is the hidden thing, okay? The educational institutions, close to our heart, they're not paying a dime towards this. This is part of the funding of the general organization. And we must remember this. There's value to a general organization that you don't see things right away. Of course, I would argue maybe we got too many institutions, just like we got too many layers. But how can we trim the fat lady down? Now, the brethren don't want me to raise the institutional issue, so I'm sworn to silence in large public gatherings. Mixed company, you know. But, you know, these are issues that we need to take a look at. And I would say one of the answers to the institutional overload, I just got finished presenting a paper on Ellen White at Brigham Young. Interesting place to be invited to present a paper on Ellen White. But I go to that institution, man, and they got 30,000 students. But they're not spending their money on 12 or 13 different administrations in various places, and science labs, and this, and that. Maybe we need, and I've had this one in my head a long time, at Adventist University West, Adventist University East, with the regional groups providing colleges within the university. Anyway, there's all kinds of organizational models. But we don't have to do anything at any level. But the main thing is, Bob, I think part of the answer here is we need to be able to have more options at the local level, both in terms of programming and in terms of finances. The problem is not Michigan mission overseas anymore. I was standing with three Union Conference presidents in North America here, and Bill Johnson, editor of the Review, walked by, and I said, Bill, I read all about the Union Conference presidents going to Africa and baptizing 3,000 people. I said, would you write a major article if somebody went to San Francisco and baptized three, a Union Conference president? The problems that we're facing today is not how to evangelize Africa. The problem is how to reach secular North America, secular Europeans. We have got to start putting more energy in 50 years. In 50 years, the largest unreached people group in the world could be North Americans born in this country. That is whites. But I'm telling you right now, you may have a different idea, because now we have over 1 million members in North America. It's not only the white North Americans, I'm talking about people born in North America. That population is shrinking. So is the blacks, Hispanics, and Asians. Growth is coming through immigration in all four groups. Reaching indigenous people is not our thing. We're doing evangelism overseas, and it's coming back. And just take New York as a case. Two conferences, largely island churches. Where are the North American blacks? Where are the North American Hispanics? Where are the North American blacks? We need to rethink this whole business of mission. It's not what it used to be. It's a new game, and it takes a lot of money and imagination.
Question, you talked about flexibility versus structure.
And I'm talking about flexible structures.
Flexibility
structure. In structures.
But can that end up being a way of maintaining structure and allowing flexibility where people are insisting on it, but meanwhile, all the rest of the structure keeps paying the people that are in it and everything else? That's the question I had with the flexibility part.
Yeah, I have no problem with structure. And once you get a structure, you know, voted in a particular division, that's probably the structure you're going to have. But I do think that we as members have a responsibility you're going to say, well, nobody ever hears me. Look, if enough people are talking, people are going to hear you. I believe that. There's a conference not 1 million miles from here. Somebody said, well, these people always come so organized, we don't have anything to say to constituency. I said, look, if you spend half as much time organizing as they spend organizing, you could do something. But you've got to put an investment into it. And the problem is, you see, too often it's only one part of the system that organizes. If people want to make a voice, then they've got to get together and be heard. But there's nothing wrong with, there's going to be, once you have a structure in a particular part of the world, it's still going to be a structure. Until they vote to change it. Flexibility will probably be between divisions and giving options. My argument has been that even in this richest of divisions, we've got more than we can afford. When I raised these issues at the North American Division year-end meetings a year and a half ago, some of the local conference presidents says, let's have a meeting in the evening. The meeting went for about 3 hours. About 30 conference presidents, about half the union conference presidents of North America, and Don Snyder from the division, and a couple of general conference guys. You could have drove a truck right down the middle between the local conference presidents and the union conference presidents and some of the others from the GC. You could have drove a truck there. Finally, the local conference president said, look, you guys have to be quiet. This is our meeting. There's not unity up there either, okay? You guys have to be quiet. This is our meeting. And then they said,
now, it looks to me like one of the problems in North America is potential isolationism and restructuring that ties so we have better pipe organs and nicer churches right here in America, yeah. The richest country in the world. And there's the great majority of humanity out there that doesn't serve Christ in any way.
Yeah, my problem is that we're not, I don't think we should just sit here and, gold plate our churches. My concern with North America is that local initiative be used for evangelism in this country. I'm quite sympathetic, particularly with the difficulties of reaching Islamic and Buddhist areas, Hindu areas. But it's becoming a crisis also in the West. And part of the answer is not just more money. To me, it's more talent that can really get in and work in the local churches with a vision towards new ways of doing evangelism among a secularizing culture. or as in Europe, a post-Christian culture in many places. At least in America, you know, you at least, when you're going to be the president, you at least have to say, you know, I'm a born-again Christian, even if my name is Billy Clinton, you know. We're not the same place that some other cultures are, but we've still got to start bridging that and putting whatever effort and creativity it takes to reaching people in these hard-to-reach places.
Okay, just two more, George, and we'll let you go.
I want to find out why we're moving to structural change. Is it being motivated by cost, you know, trying to cut costs, or is it because we are underusing the talents that we have? Is it motivated that we want, by the fact that we want to use more people who are up there and they offices and are not spreading the message? You know, if you know what is the main reason we are moving for structural change? And again, you know that when we say flexibility in structure, that whatever is being used in North America is what the other areas are going to copy. They would like to do whatever is being done in North America. And now, if we are trying to cut costs, how come then that we still have these meetings? Like you said, you went to Florida and all the divisional presidents came from the 13 divisions. And if you check the cost of flying them from the different countries and the expense that they, you know, that they went through staying in motels and the days, you know, it was, I know that it was much, and all those costs will go to those divisions, and the local people will have to pay. While we have modern technologies now where those people can be where they are, and we can still have these meetings without them flying to North America and bringing the money down here. The other thing I want to know is, you know, if the other Catholic is surviving without so many structural arms, you know, which of our own arms do you think we can eliminate and still have our focus on spreading the good news to the whole world without, without, you know, hampering, you know, hindering our success in what we want to do?
Okay, I'm not sure if I recall all of what you said. But certainly the personnel and the finances are two of the same issue, really. I think we want to get money and people working at maximum efficiency for mission. In terms of the flying all over the place, there will probably always be some meetings. I mean, we could have done this by television. You didn't need to waste the gas money. The gas is small money. But for years, I've worried about the huge amount of money that people have spent flying me around the world, especially when I didn't want to go. You know what I mean? And I think we need to begin to economize on this endless travel, whether it be a public speaker, whether it be a administrative meeting, wherever we can use technology. But there'll always be times when people need to meet face to face and, quotes, hammer it out. For years, I used to be against the quinquennium general conference sessions. When you consider how many millions of dollars are spent in a general conference session, but you know, the longer I've lived, the more I realize that that quinquennial session gives us a feeling and a sense of being a worldwide church that nothing else can do. And that for all of its expense, and as conservative as I am on these kinds of things, I've come to the place that I believe that these are productive of good. That's not the biggest leak in the church. So there are times when people need to get together. There are many times I believe we could do it. I had a phone conference yesterday with several professors at different locations on the West Coast. I mean, it was Thursday. But it was a good conference. Justifiably, if we had any money, we could have met together and had lunch. But hey, we did fine. And we ought to be doing more of that, but it can't be done for everything.
George,
now, we're not going to get back on women's ordination, are we, Madeline?
Well, I just... you don't have to if you don't want to. But I just think that you should not minimize or overlook the parallels between that discussion and this discussion. You mentioned the hermeneutical parallel. For years, we have been using James White's quotation about doing whatever the Bible does not explicitly forbid. And another parallel is the personal turf protection. And with a little time, I'm sure we could think of many others. But when you say 5 years, possibly, to discuss this before anything is done, I don't know. We've been over 40 years discussing the women's issue, and a few little gradual steps have been taken.
5 years was not the advice I gave to the General Conference president.
Yeah. Okay.
I said historically, A.T. Daniels just took over the meeting in 1901, and nobody got the agenda back. It happened.
Someone here
asked you how long it might take. Yeah. Let me just say one other thing, and this has got nothing to do with what I'm talking about. It's got to do with ordination. We don't even know why we ordain people. We have a Catholic view of organization. It's ordination, that you give people some kind of power. Just like in the Mass, something magical happens. You know, in baptism, sin is removed. No, no, no. We're Protestants. This is a recognition that Jesus died for me. This is a recognition that you've accepted Jesus when I baptize you. When you ordain somebody, no power is transferred. God has blessed your ministry. The church recognizes it. The arguments against women's ordination are our sacerdotal presuppositions. Without the sacerdotalism, if you put it on the same level with the ordinances, which they are parallel, you have shot the opposition. But these people come along and they've got this sacerdotal approach. Well, I've often said those who dislike the Roman Catholic Church the most among the Adventists are most like them, including the vegetarian Virgin Mary and tradition.
Let's thank George for the time that he's given here. And let's all stand. I've asked Lucille Hagenroot to close with prayer today.
Oh, Almighty God in heaven, we love you so much and we praise your holy name. We ask your blessing as we are dismissed now. And we look forward to the time when we'll have the vision and the wisdom to do those things that will bring us closer to the government in heaven, where we can be close to Jesus. Thank you.